Audio Renaissance presents The Shadow of the Giant by Orson Scott Card. Read for you by David Burney, Scott Brick, Gabrielle DeCure, Stephen Hoy, Carrington McDuffie, Moira Quirk, and Stefan Rudnicki. Chapter 1. Mandate of Heaven. From Graf, pilgrimage@colmin.gov, to Soup, battleboys@strategyandplanning.han.gov. Ray, free vacation offer. Destination of your choice in the known universe. And we pick you up.
Hanzo waited until the armored car was completely out of sight before he ventured out into the bicycle and pedestrian-packed street. Crowds could make you invisible, but only if you were moving in the same direction, and that's the thing Hanzo had never really been able to do, not since he came home to China from battle school. He always seemed to be moving not upstream, but crossways, as if he had a completely different map of the world from the one everyone around him was using. And here he was again, dodging bikes and forward-pressing people on their 10,000 errands in order to get from the doorway of his apartment building to the door of the tiny restaurant across the street. But it was not as hard as it would have been for most people. Hanzo had mastered the art of using only his peripheral vision, so his eyes stared straight ahead. Without eye contact, the others on the street could not face him down, could not insist that he yield the right of way. They could only dodge him as if he were a boulder in the stream. He put his hand to the door and hesitated. He did not know why he had not been arrested and killed, or sent for retraining already. But if he was photographed taking this meeting, then it would be easy to prove that he was a traitor. Then again, his enemies didn't need evidence to convict. All they needed was the inclination. So he opened the door, listened to the tinkle of the little bell, and walked toward the back of the narrow corridor between booths. He knew he shouldn't expect Graf himself, for the Minister of Colonization to come to Earth would be news, and Graf avoided news unless it was useful to him, which this would certainly not be. So whom would Graf send? Someone from battle school, undoubtedly. A teacher? Another student? Someone from Ender's Geesh? Would this be a reunion? To his surprise, the man in the last booth sat with his back toward the door, so all Hanzo could see was his curly, steel-gray hair, not Chinese, and from the color of his ears, not European. The pertinent fact, though, was that he was not facing the door and could not see Hanzo's approach. However, once Hanzo sat down, he would be facing the door, able to observe the whole room. That was the smart way to do it. After all, Hanzo was the one who would recognize trouble if it came in the door, not this foreigner, this stranger. But few operatives on a mission this dangerous would have the brass to turn their backs on the door just because the person they were meeting would be a better observer. The man did not turn as Hanzo approached. Was he unobservant or supremely confident? "Hello," the man said softly just as Hanzo came up beside him. "Please sit down." Hanzo slid into the booth opposite him and knew that he knew this old man but could not name him. "Please don't say my name," said the man softly. "Easy," said Hanzo. "I don't remember it." "Oh, yes you do," said the man. "You just don't remember my face. You haven't seen me very often, but the leader of the Geesh spent a lot of time with me." Now Hanzo remembered. Those last weeks in command school, on Eros, when they thought they were in training but were really leading far-off fleets in the endgame of the war against the Hive Queens. Ender, their commander, had been kept separate from them, but they learned afterward that an old half-Maori cargo ship captain had been working closely with him, training him, goading him, pretending to be his opponent in simulated games. Maser Rackham, the hero who saved the human race from certain destruction in the second invasion. Everyone thought he died in the war, but he had been sent out on a meaningless voyage at near light speed so that relativistic effects would keep him alive so he'd be there for the last battles of the war. He was ancient history twice over. That time on Eros, as a part of Ender's Jeesh, seemed like another lifetime. And Maser Rackham had been the most famous man in the world for decades before that. Most famous man in the world, but almost nobody knew his face. "Everyone knows you piloted the first colony ship," said Hanzu. "We lied," said Maser Rackham. Hanzu accepted that and waited in silence. "There is a place for you as head of a colony," said Rackham. "A former hive world with mostly Han Chinese colonists and many interesting challenges for a leader. The ship leaves as soon as you board it." That was the offer. The dream, to be out of the turmoil of Earth, the devastation of China, instead of waiting to be executed by the angry and feeble Chinese government, instead of watching the Chinese people writhe under the heel of the Muslim conquerors, he could board a beautiful, clean starship and let them fling him out into space to a world where human feet had never stepped, to be the founding leader of a colony that would hold his name in reverence forever. He would marry, have children, and in all likelihood be happy. "How long do I have to decide?" asked Hanzu. Rackham glanced at his watch, then looked back at him without answering. "Not a very long window of opportunity," said Hanzu. Rackham shook his head. "It's a very attractive offer," said Hanzu. Rackham nodded. "But I wasn't born for such happiness," said Hanzu. "The present government of China has lost the mandate of heaven. If I live through the transition, I might be useful to the new government."
"And that's what you were born for?" asked Rackham.
"They tested me," said Hanzu. "And I'm a child of war." Rackham nodded. Then he reached inside his jacket and took out a pen and laid it on the table.
"What's that?" asked Hanzu. "The mandate of heaven," said Rackham.
Hanzu knew then that the pen was a weapon, because the mandate of heaven was always bestowed in blood and war.
"The items in the cap are extremely delicate," said Rackham. "Practice with round toothpicks."
Then he got up and walked out the back door of the restaurant. No doubt there was some kind of transport waiting there. Hanzu wanted to leap to his feet and run after him so he could be taken out into space and set free of all that lay ahead. Instead, he put his hand over the pen and slid it across the table, then put it into the pocket of his trousers. It was a weapon, which meant Graf and Rackham expected him to need a personal weapon soon. How soon? Hanzu took 6 toothpicks out of the little dispenser that stood on the table against the wall, beside the soy sauce. Then he got up and went to the toilet. He pulled the cap off the pen very carefully, so he didn't spill out the 4 feather-ended poison darts bunched in it. Then he unscrewed the top of the pen. There were 4 holes there, besides the central shaft that held the tube of ink. The mechanism was cleverly designed to rotate automatically with each discharge. A blowgun revolver. He loaded 4 toothpicks into the 4 slots. They fit loosely. Then he screwed the pen back together. The fountain pen writing tip covered the hole where the darts would emerge. When he held the top of the pen in his mouth, the point of the writing tip served as the sighting device, point and shoot. Point and blow. He blew. The toothpick hit the back wall of the bathroom, more or less where he was aiming, only a foot lower. Definitely a close-range weapon. He used up the rest of the toothpicks, learning how high to aim in order to hit a target 6 feet away. The room wasn't large enough for him to practice aiming at anything farther. Then he gathered up the toothpicks, threw them away, and carefully loaded the pen with the real darts, handling them only by the feathered part of the shaft. Then he flushed the toilet and re-entered the restaurant. No one was waiting for him. So he sat down and ordered and ate methodically. No reason to face the crisis of his life with an empty stomach, and the food here wasn't bad. He paid and walked out into the street. He would not go home. If he waited there to be arrested, he would have to deal with any number of low-level thugs who would not be worth wasting a dart on. Instead, he flagged down a bicycle taxi and headed for the Ministry of Defense. The place was as crowded as ever. Pathetically so, thought Hanzo. There was a reason for so many military bureaucrats a few years ago, when China was conquering Indochina and India, its millions of soldiers spread out to rule over a billion conquered people. But now, the government had direct control only over Manchuria and the northern part of Han China. Persians and Arabs and Indonesians administered martial law in the great port cities of the south, and large armies of Turks were poised in Inner Mongolia, ready to slice through Chinese defenses at a moment's notice. Another large Chinese army was isolated in Sichuan, forbidden by the government to surrender any portion of their troops, forcing them to sustain a multi-million-man force from the production of that single province. In effect, they were under siege, getting weaker, and more hated by the civilian population all the time. There had even been a coup right after the ceasefire, but it was a sham, a reshuffling of the politicians, nothing but an excuse for repudiating the terms of the ceasefire. No one in the military bureaucracy had lost his job. It was the military that had been driving China's new expansionism. It was the military that had failed. Only Hanzo had been relieved of his duties and sent home. They could not forgive him for having named their stupidity for what it was. He had warned them every step of the way. They had ignored every warning. Each time he had shown them a way out of their self-induced dilemmas, they had ignored his offered plans and proceeded to make decisions based on bravado, face-saving, and delusions of Chinese invincibility. At his last meeting, he had left them with no face at all. He had stood there, a very young man in the presence of old men of enormous authority, and called them the fools they were. He laid out exactly why they had failed so miserably. He even told them that they had lost the mandate of heaven, the traditional excuse for a change of dynasty. This was the unforgivable sin, since the present dynasty claimed not to be a dynasty at all, not to be an empire, but rather to be a perfect expression of the will of the people. What they forgot was that the Chinese people still believed in the mandate of heaven, and knew when a government no longer had it. Now, as he showed his expired ID at the gate of the complex and was admitted without hesitation, he realized that there was only one fathomable reason why they hadn't already arrested him or had him killed. They didn't dare. It confirmed that Rackham was right to hand him a four-shot weapon and call it the Mandate of Heaven. There were forces at work here within the Defense Department that Hanzo could not see, waiting in his apartment for someone to decide what to do with him. They had not even cut off his salary. There was panic and confusion in the military, and now Hanzo knew that he was at the center of it, that his silence, his waiting, had actually been a pestle constantly grinding at the mortar of military failure. He should have known that his j'accuse speech would have more effects than merely to humiliate and enrage his superiors. There were aides standing against the walls listening, and they would know that every word that Hanzo said was true. For all Hanzo knew, his death or arrest had already been ordered a dozen times, and the aides who had been given those orders no doubt could prove that they had passed them along. but they would also have passed along the story of Hanzu, the former battle schooler who had been part of Ender's Jeesh. The soldiers ordered to arrest him would have also been told that if Hanzu had been heeded, China would not have been defeated by the Muslims and their strutting boy caliph. The Muslims won because they had the brains to put their member of Ender's Jeesh, Caliph Ali, in charge of their armies, in charge of their whole government, their religion itself. But the Chinese government had rejected their own Enderman, and now were giving orders for his arrest. In these conversations, the phrase, "Mandate of Heaven," would certainly have been spoken. And the soldiers, if they left their quarters at all, seemed unable to locate Hanzu's apartment. For all these weeks since the war ended, the leadership must already have come face to face with their own powerlessness. If the soldiers would not follow them on such a simple matter as arresting the political enemy who had shamed them, then they were in grave danger. That's why Hanzu's ID was accepted at the gate. That's why he was allowed to walk unescorted among the buildings of the Defense Department complex. Not completely unescorted, for he saw through his peripheral vision that a growing number of soldiers and functionaries were shadowing him, moving along the buildings in paths parallel to his own. For, of course, the gate guards would have spread the word at once, "He's here." So when he walked up to the entrance of the highest headquarters, he paused at the top step and turned around. Several thousand men and women were already in the space between buildings, and more were coming all the time. Many of them were soldiers under arms. Hanzu looked them over, watching as their numbers grew. No one spoke. He bowed to them. They bowed back. Hanzu turned and entered the building. The guards inside the doors also bowed to him. He bowed to each of them and then proceeded to the stairs leading to the second-floor office suites, where the highest officers of the military were certainly waiting for him. Sure enough, he was met on the second floor by a young woman in uniform who bowed and said, "Most respectfully, sir, will you come to the office of the one called Snow Tiger?" Her voice was devoid of sarcasm, but the name Snow Tiger carried its own irony these days. Hanzo looked at her gravely. "What is your name, soldier?"
"Lieutenant White Lotus," she said.
"Lieutenant," said Hanzu, "if heaven should bestow its mandate upon the true emperor today, would you serve him?"
"My life will be his," she said.
"And your pistol?" She bowed deeply. He bowed to her, then followed her to Snow Tiger's office. They were all gathered there in the large anteroom, the men who had been present weeks ago when Hanzu had scorned them for having lost the mandate of heaven. Their eyes were cold now, but he had no friends among these high officers. Snow Tiger stood in the doorway of his inner office. It was unheard of for him to come out to meet anyone except members of the Politburo, none of whom were present. "Hanzu," he said. Hanzu bowed slightly. Snow Tiger bowed almost invisibly in return. "I am happy to see you return to duty after your well-earned vacation," said Snow Tiger. Hanzu only stood in the middle of the room, regarding him steadily. "Please come into my office." Hanzu walked slowly toward the open door. He knew that Lieutenant White Lotus stood at the door, watching to make sure that no one raised a hand to harm him. Through the open door, Hanzu could see two armed soldiers flanking Snow Tiger's desk. Hanzu stopped, regarding each of the soldiers in turn. Their faces showed nothing. They did not even look back at him. But he knew that they understood who he was. They had been chosen by Snow Tiger because he trusted them. But he should not have. Snow Tiger took Hanzu's pause as an invitation for him to enter the office first. Hanzo did not follow him inside until Snow Tiger was seated at his desk. Then Hanzo entered.
"Please close the door," said Snow Tiger.
Hanzo turned around and pulled the door all the way open. Snow Tiger took his disobedience without blinking. What could he do or say without making himself seem pathetic? Snow Tiger pushed a paper toward Hanzo. It was an order giving him command over the army that was slowly starving in Sichuan province.
"You have proved your great wisdom many times," said Snow Tiger. "We ask you now to be the salvation of China and lead this great army against our enemy."
Hanzo did not even bother to answer. A hungry, ill-equipped, demoralized, surrounded army was not going to accomplish miracles, and Hanzo had no intention of accepting this or any other assignment from Snow Tiger.
"Sir, these are excellent orders," said Hanzo loudly. He glanced at each of the soldiers standing beside the desk.
"Do you see how excellent these orders are?" Unused to being spoken to directly in such a high-level meeting, one of the soldiers nodded. The other merely shifted uncomfortably.
"I see only one error," said Hanzo. His voice was loud enough to be heard in the anteroom as well.
Snow Tiger grimaced.
"There is no error."
"Let me take my pen and show you," said Hanzo. He took the pen from his shirt pocket and uncapped it. Then he drew a line through his own name at the top of the paper. Turning around to face the open door, Hanzo said,
"There is no one in this building with the authority to command me."
It was his announcement that he was taking control of the government, and everyone knew it.
"Shoot him," said Snow Tiger behind him.
Hanzo turned around, putting the pen to his mouth as he did. But before he could fire a dart, the soldier who had refused to nod had blown out Snow Tiger's head, covering the other soldier with a smear of blood and brains and bone fragments. The two soldiers bowed deeply to Hanzo. Hanzo turned back around and strode out into the anteroom. Several of the old generals were heading for the door, but Lieutenant White Lotus had her pistol out, and they all froze in place.
"Emperor Hanzo has not given the honorable gentleman his permission to leave," she said.
Hanzo spoke to the soldiers behind him.
"Please assist the lieutenant in securing this room," he said. "It is my judgment that the officers in this room need time to contemplate upon the question of how China came into her current difficult situation. I would like them to remain in here until each of them has written a complete explanation of how so many mistakes came to be made, and how they think matters should have been conducted."
As Hanzo expected, the suck-ups immediately went to work, dragging their compatriots back to their places against the walls. "Didn't you hear the Emperor's request? We will do as you ask, Steward of Heaven." Little good it would do them. Hanzo already knew perfectly well which officers he would trust to lead the Chinese military. The irony was that the great men who were now humiliated and writing reports on their own mistakes were never the source of those errors. They only believed they were. And the underlings who had really originated the problems saw themselves as merely instruments of their commander's will. But it was in the nature of underlings to use power recklessly, since blame could always be passed either upward or downward. Unlike credit, which, like hot air, always rose, as it will rise to me from now on. Hanzo left the offices of the late Snow Tiger. In the corridor, soldiers stood at every door. They had heard the single gunshot, and Hanzo was pleased to see that they all looked relieved to learn that it was not Hanzo himself who had been shot. He turned to one soldier and said, "Please enter the nearest office and telephone for medical attention for the Honorable Snow Tiger." To three others he said, "Please help Lieutenant White Lotus secure the cooperation of the former generals inside this room who have been asked to write reports for me." As they rushed to obey, Hansa gave assignments to the other soldiers and bureaucrats. Some of them would later be purged, others would be elevated. But at this moment, no one even thought of disobeying him. Within only a few minutes, he had given orders to have the perimeter of the defense complex sealed. Until he was ready, he wanted no warning going to the Politburo. But his precaution was in vain, for when he went down the stairs and walked out of the building, he was greeted by a roar from the thousands and thousands of military people who completely surrounded the headquarters building. "Hanzu," they shouted, "chosen of heaven." There was no chance the noise would not be heard outside the complex. So instead of rounding up the Politburo all at once, he would have to waste time tracking them down as they fled to the countryside or tried to get to the airport or onto the river. But of one thing there could be no doubt. With the new emperor enthusiastically supported by the armed forces, there would be no resistance to his rule by any Chinese, anywhere. That's what Mazur Rackham and Hiram Graff had understood when they gave him his choice. Their only miscalculation was how completely the story of Hansa's wisdom had swept through the military. He hadn't needed the blowgun after all. Though, if he hadn't had it, would he have had the courage to act as boldly as he did? One thing Hanzu did not doubt. If the soldier had not killed Snow Tiger first, Hanzu would have done it after, and would have killed both soldiers if they had not immediately submitted to his rule. "My hands are clean, but not because I wasn't prepared to bloody them." As he made his way to the Department of Planning and Strategy, where he would make his temporary headquarters, he could not help but ask himself, "What if I had taken their initial offer and fled into space? What would have happened to China then?" And then, a more sobering question, "What will happen to China now?"
Chapter 2. Mother. From H. Mebane, Genetic Therapy at mayoflorida.org.us, to Julian Delfiki, Carlotta at delfikiconsultations.com. Ray, prognosis. "Dear Julian, I wish I had better news, but yesterday's tests are conclusive. Estrogen therapy has had no effect on the epiphyses. They remain open, even though you definitely do not have any defect in the estrogen receptors on the growth plates of your bone. As to your second request, of course we will continue to study your DNA, my friend, whether any of your missing embryos are found or not. What was done once can be done again, and Volescu's mistakes may be repeated with some other genetic alteration in the future. But the history of genetic research is fairly consistent. It takes time to map and isolate an unusual sequence, and then perform animal experiments in order to determine what each portion of it does and how to counteract its effects. There is no way to expedite such research. If we had 10,000 working on the problem, they would perform the same experiments in the same order, and it would take the same amount of time. Someday we will understand why your astonishing intellect is so incurably linked with uncontrolled growth. Right now, to be candid, it seems to be almost malicious on the part of nature, as if there were some law that the price for the unleashing of human intellect is either autism or giantism. If only, instead of military training, you had been taught biochemistry, so that at your present age you could be up to speed in this field, I have no doubt that you would be more likely to have the kind of insights we need than we of fettered intellect. That is the bitter irony of your condition and your personal history. Even Volescu could not have anticipated the consequence of his alteration of your genes. I feel like a coward delivering this information in an email instead of face-to-face, but you insisted on no delay and a written report. The technical data will, of course, be forwarded to you as the final reports become available. If only cryogenics had not proven to be such a barren field. Sincerely, Howard."
As soon as Bob left for his shift as night manager of the grocery store, Randy sat down in front of the screen and started the special on Achille Flandre over again from the beginning. It galled her to hear how they slandered him, but by now she was adept at tuning it out. Megalomaniac, madman, murderer. Why couldn't they see him as he really was? A genius like Alexander the Great, who came this close to uniting the world and ending war forever. Now the dogs would fight over the scraps of Achille's achievements while his body rested in an obscure grave in some miserable tropical village in Brazil. And the assassin who had ended Achille's life, who had thwarted his greatness, he was being honored as if there were something heroic about putting a bullet into the eye of an unarmed man. Julian Delfeeky. Bean, the tool of the evil hegemon Peter Wiggin. Delfeeky and Wiggin, unworthy to be on the same planet with Achille. And yet they claim to be his heirs, the rightful rulers of the world. Well, poor fools, you're the heirs of nothing, because I know where Achille's true heir is. She patted her stomach, though that was a dangerous thing to do, what with her puking at a moment's notice ever since the pregnancy really took hold. She didn't show yet, and when she did, it was a 50-50 chance whether Bob would throw her out or keep her and accept the child as his own. Bob knew he couldn't father children. They'd had enough tests. And there was no point in pretending, since he'd ask for a DNA test and then he'd know anyway. And she had sworn never to tell that she had received an implant, after all. She would have to pretend that she had had an affair with somebody and wanted to keep the baby. Bob would not like that at all. But she knew that her baby's life depended on keeping the secret. The man who interviewed her at the fertility clinic had been adamant about that. It doesn't matter whom you tell, Randy. The enemies of the great man know that this embryo exists. They'll be searching for it. They'll be watching all the women in the world who give birth within a certain time frame. And any rumor that a baby was implanted rather than naturally conceived will bring them like hounds. Their resources are unlimited. They will spare no effort in their search. And when they find a woman that they even think might be the mother of his child, they will kill her, just in case. But there must be hundreds, thousands of women who have babies implanted, Randy protested. Are you a Christian? Asked the man. You've heard of the slaughter of the innocents. However many you have to kill, it's worth it to these monsters, as long as it means they can prevent the birth of this child. Randy watched the stills of Achille during his battle school days and soon after, during his time at the asylum, where his enemies had him confined after it became clear that he was a better commander than their precious Ender Wiggin. She had read it on the nets in many places, the fact that Ender Wiggin actually used plans devised by Achille in order to beat the buggers. They could glorify their phony little hero all they wanted, but everyone knew it was only because he was Peter Wiggin's little brother that Ender was given all the credit. It was Achille who had saved the world, and Achille who had fathered the baby she had chosen to bear. Randy's only regret was that she could not be the biological mother as well, and that the child could not have been naturally conceived. But she knew that the bride of Achille must have been very carefully chosen, a woman who could contribute the right genes so as not to dilute his brilliance and goodness and creativity and drive. But they knew about the woman Achille loved, and if she had been pregnant when he died, they would have torn the womb out of her so she could lie there in agony and watch them burn the fetus before her eyes. So to protect the mother and the baby, Achille had arranged for their embryo to be taken secretly and implanted in the womb of a woman who could be trusted to take the child to term and give him a good home and raise him with full awareness of his vast potential. To teach him secretly who he really was and whose cause he served, so he could grow up to fulfill his father's cruelly blocked destiny. It was a sacred trust, and Randy was worthy of it. Bob was not. It was that simple. Randy had always known that she married beneath herself. Bob was a good provider, but he hadn't the imagination to understand anything more important than making a living and planning his next fishing trip. She could just imagine how he would respond if she told him that not only was she pregnant, but the baby was not even hers. Already, she had found several places on the web where people were searching for lost or kidnapped embryos. She knew, the man who spoke to her had warned her, that these were likely to originate from Ashiel's enemies, trolling for information that would lead them to her. She wondered if maybe the very act of searching for people searching for embryos would alert them. The search companies claimed that no government had access to their databases, but it was possible that the international fleet was intercepting all the messages and monitoring all the searches. People said that the IF was really under the control of the United States government, that America's isolationism was a facade, and it ran everything through the IF. Then there were the people who said that it was the other way around. The U.S. was isolationist because that was the way the IF wanted it, since most of the space technology they depended on was developed and built in the U.S. It couldn't be an accident that Peter the Hegemon was American himself. She would stop searching for information about kidnapped embryos. It was all lies and traps and tricks. She knew she would seem paranoid to anyone else, but that's only because they didn't know what she knew. There really were monsters in the world, and those who kept secrets from them had to live with constant vigilance. There on the screen was that terrible picture. They showed it over and over again. Ashiel's poor, broken body lying on the floor in the Hegemon's palace, looking so peaceful, not a wound on his body. Some on the net said that Delphiki didn't shoot him through the eye at all, that if he had, Ashiel's face would have been powder burned, and there would have been an exit wound and blood all over. No, Delphiki and Wigan imprisoned Ashiel and faked some kind of phony standoff with the police, pretending that Ashiel was taking hostages or something, so they'd have an excuse for killing him. But in fact, they gave him a lethal injection, or poisoned his food, or infected him with a hideous disease so he died writhing on the floor in agony while Delphiki and Wigan looked on. Like Richard III murdering those poor princes in the tower. But when my son is born, Randy told herself, then all these false histories will be destroyed. The liars will be eliminated, and so will their lies. Then this footage will be used in a true story. My son will see to that. No one will ever even hear the lies they're telling now. And Ashiel will be known as the Great One, even greater than the son who will have completed his life's work. And I will be remembered and honored as the woman who sheltered him and gave him birth and raised him up to rule the world. All I have to do to accomplish that is nothing. Nothing that calls attention to me, nothing that makes me unusual or strange. Yet the one thing she couldn't bear to do was nothing, just to sit here watching the television, worrying, fretting. It had to be harmful for the baby to have so much adrenaline coursing through her system. It was the waiting that was making her crazy, not waiting for the baby. That was natural, and she would love every day of her pregnancy. It was waiting for her life to change, waiting for Bob. Why should she wait for Bob? She got up from the couch, switched off the television, went into the bedroom, and started packing her clothing and other things into cardboard boxes. She emptied out Bob's obsessive financial records in order to empty the boxes, let him amuse himself by sorting them out later. Only after she had packed and taped up the fourth box did it occur to her that the normal pattern would have been to tell him about the baby and then make him move out. But she didn't want a connection with him, didn't want any dispute about paternity. She just wanted to be gone, out of his ordinary, meaningless life, out of this pointless town. Of course, she couldn't just disappear. Then she'd be a missing person. She'd be added to databases. Someone would be alerted. So she took her boxes of clothing and a few favorite pots, pans, and recipe books and loaded them into the car that she had owned before she married Bob and that was still in her name alone. Then she spent half an hour writing different versions of a letter to Bob, explaining that she didn't love him anymore and was leaving and didn't want him to look for her. No, nothing in writing, nothing that can be reported to anyone. She got in the car and drove to the grocery store. On the way in from the parking lot, she took a cart that someone had left blocking a parking space and pushed it into the store. Helping keep the parking lot clear of abandoned carts proved that she wasn't vindictive. She was a civilized person who wanted to help Bob do well in his business and his ordinary, ordinary, ordinary life. It would help him not to have such an extraordinary woman and child in that life. He was out on the floor, and instead of waiting in his office, she went in search of him. She found him supervising the unloading of a truck that was late because of a breakdown on the highway, making sure that the frozen foods were at a low enough temperature to be safely offloaded and shelved. "Can you wait just a minute?" he said. "I know it's important, or you wouldn't have come down here, but..." "Oh, Bob, it won't take more than a second." She leaned close to him. "I'm pregnant, and it's not yours." Being a two-part message, it didn't entirely register right away. For a moment, he looked happy. Then his face started to turn red. She leaned in close again. "Don't worry, though. I'm leaving you. I'll let you know where to mail the divorce papers. Now you get back to work." She started to walk away. "Randy!" he called after her. "Not your fault, Bob," she called over her shoulder. "Nothing was your fault. You're a great guy." She felt liberated as she walked back through the store. Her mood was so generous and expansive that she bought a little container of lip balm and a bottle of water. The tiny amount of profit from the sale would be her last contribution to Bob's life. Then she got into the car and drove south, because that way was a right turn coming out of the parking lot, and traffic was too heavy to wait for a chance to go left. She'd drive wherever the currents of the traffic led her. She wouldn't try to hide from anybody. She'd let Bob know where she was as soon as she decided she was there, and she'd divorce him in a perfectly ordinary way. But she wouldn't bump into anyone she knew or anyone who knew her. She would become effectively invisible, not like someone trying to hide, but like someone who had nothing to hide at all, but who never became important to anyone, except to her beloved son.
Chapter 3. Coup. From Julian Delfiki, Milcom at hegemon.gov, to Valescu, Levers at plasticgenome.edu. Ray, why keep hiding when you don't have to? Look, if we wanted you dead or punished, don't you think it would have happened already? Your protector is gone, and there's not a country on earth that will protect you if we lay out the facts of your achievements. What you did, you did. Now help us find our children wherever you've hidden them.
Peter Wiggin had brought Petra Arcanian with him because she knew Caliph Alai. They had both been in Ender's Jeesh together. And it was Alai who had sheltered her and Bean in the weeks before the Muslim invasion of China, or liberation of Asia, depending on which propaganda mill you shopped at. But now it seemed that having Petra with him meant nothing at all. Nobody in Damascus acted as if it even mattered that the hegemon had come like a supplicant to see the caliph. Not that Peter had arrived with any publicity. This was a private visit, with him and Petra passing themselves off as a tourist couple, complete with bickering. Because Petra had no patience with him. Everything he did and said and even thought was wrong. And last night, when he finally demanded, "Tell me what you really hate about me, Petra, instead of pretending it's all this trivial stuff," her answer had been devastating. "Because the only difference I ever saw between you and Ashil was that you let others do your killing for you." It was so patently unfair. Peter had devoted himself to trying to avoid war. At least now he knew why she was so furious at him. When Bean went into the besieged hegemony compound to face Ashil alone, Peter understood that Bean was putting his own life on the line and that it was extremely unlikely that Ashil would give him what he had promised, the embryos of Bean's and Petra's children that had been stolen from a hospital soon after in vitro fertilization. So when Bean put a 22 slug through Achille's eye and let it bounce around a few dozen times inside his skull, the only person who absolutely got everything he needed was Peter himself. He got the hegemony compound back. He got all the hostages safely returned. He even regained his tiny army, trained by Bean and led by Suryawong, who had turned out to be loyal after all. Well, Bean and Petra did not get their babies, and Bean was dying, and Peter couldn't do a thing to help either of them, except provide office space and computers for them to conduct their search. He also used all his connections to get them whatever cooperation he could from the nations where they needed access to records. Right after Achille's death, Petra had simply been relieved. Her irritation with Peter had developed, or merely resurfaced, in the weeks after, as she saw him trying to reestablish the prestige of the Office of Hegemon and trying to put together a coalition. She began making snotty little comments about Peter playing in his geopolitical sandbox and outstrutting the heads of state. He should have expected that actually having her travel along with him would only make it worse, especially because he wasn't following her advice about anything. "You can't just show up," she told him. "I have no choice. It's disrespectful, as if you think you can drop in on the Caliph. It's treating him like a servant." "That's why I brought you," Peter patiently explained, "so you can see him and explain that the only way this can happen is if it's a secret meeting. But he already told me, and Bean, that we couldn't have access to him like we used to. We're infidels. He's Caliph. The Pope sees non-Catholics all the time. He sees me." "The Pope isn't Muslim," said Petra. "Just be patient," said Peter. "Allah knows we're here. Eventually, he'll decide to see me. Eventually? I'm pregnant, Mr. Hegemon, and my husband is dying in a big way. Ha, ha, ha. And you're wasting some of the time we have together, and that pisses me off. I invited you to come. I didn't compel you. It's a good thing you didn't try. But now it was out, in the open, clear at last. Of course, she was really irritated at all the things she complained about, but underneath it all was resentment about how Peter had let Bean do his killing for him. Petra, said Peter, I'm not a soldier.
Neither is Bean.
Bean is the finest military mind alive, said Peter.
So why isn't he Hegemon?
Because he doesn't want to be. And you do, and that's why I hate you, since you asked. You know why I wanted this office and what I'm trying to do with it. You've read my Locke essays.
I also read your Demosthenes essays.
Those also needed to be written, but I intend to govern as Locke.
You govern nothing. The only reason you even have your little army is because Bean and Suryawong created it and decided to let you have the use of it. You only have your precious compound and all your staff because Bean killed Achille and gave it back to you. And now you're back to putting on your little show of importance. But you know what? Nobody's fooled. You're not even as powerful as the Pope. He's got the Vatican and 1 billion Catholics. You've got nothing but what my husband gave you. Peter didn't think this was quite accurate. He had labored for years to build up his network of contacts, and he had kept the office of Hegemon from being abolished. Over the years, he'd made it mean something. He had saved Haiti from chaos. Several small nations owed their independence or freedom to his diplomatic and, yes, military intervention. But certainly he was on the verge of losing it all to Achille because of his own stupid mistake, a mistake that Bean and Petra had warned him about before he made it, a mistake that Bean had rectified, only at grave risk. "Petra," said Peter, "you're right. I owe everything to you and Bean. But that doesn't change the fact that whatever you think of me and whatever you think of the office of Hegemon, I hold that office, and I'm trying to use it to avoid another bloody war." You're trying to use your office to make your office into dictator of the world. Unless you can figure out a way to extend your reach out into the colonies and become dictator of the known universe. We don't actually have any colonies yet, said Peter. The ships are all still in transit and will be until we're all dead. But by the time they arrive, I'd like them to send their Ansible messages back home to an Earth that is united under a single democratic government. It's the democratic part I missed, said Petra. Who elected you? Since I don't have any actual authority over anybody, Petra, how can it possibly matter if I'm not legitimately authorized? You argue like a debater, she said. You don't actually have to have an idea, you just have to have a seemingly clever refutation. And you argue like a 9-year-old, said Peter, sticking your fingers in your ears and going, la, 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 insane to you, and Petra looked like she wanted to slap him. Instead, she put her fingers in her ears and said, same to you, and la, la, la. He did not laugh. Instead, he reached out a hand, intending to pull her arm away from her ear. But she whirled around and kicked his hand so hard that he thought she might have broken his wrist. As it was, he staggered and stumbled over the corner of the bed in his hotel room and ended up on his butt on the floor. There's the hegemon of Earth, said Petra. Where's your camera? Don't you want this to be public? If I wanted to destroy you, you'd be destroyed. Petra, I didn't send Bean into that compound. Bean sent himself. You let him go. Yes, I did, and in the event, I was proven right. But you didn't know he'd live. I was carrying his baby, and you sent him in to die. Nobody sends Bean anywhere, said Peter, and you know it. She whirled away from him and stalked out of the room. She would have slammed the door, but the pneumatics prevented it. He had seen, though, the tears in her eyes. She didn't hate Peter. She wanted to hate him. But what she really was furious about was that her husband was dying, and she had agreed to this mission because she knew it would be important. If it worked, it would be important. But it wasn't working. It probably wouldn't work. Peter knew that. But he also knew that he had to talk to Caliph Ali, and he had to do it now if the conversation was to have any good effect. If possible, he'd like to have the conversation without risking the prestige of the office of hegemon. But the longer they delayed, the greater the likelihood of word of his trip to Damascus getting out. And then, if Ali rebuffed him, the humiliation would be public, and the office of hegemon would be greatly diminished. So Petra's judgment of him was obviously unfair. If all he cared about was his own authority, he wouldn't be here. And she was clever enough to know that. She got into battle school, didn't she? She was the only girl among Ender's Geesh. Had certified her as his superior, at least in the area of strategy and leadership. Surely she must see that he was putting the goal of preventing a bloody war above his own career. As soon as he thought of this, he heard her voice inside his head saying, "Oh, isn't that fine and noble of you, to put the lives of hundreds of thousands of soldiers ahead of your own indelible place in history? Do you think you get a prize for that?" Or else she'd say, "The only reason I'm along is specifically so you can avoid risking anything." Or else, "You've always been bold as a risk-taker, when the stakes are high enough and your own life isn't on the line." This is great, Peter, he thought. You don't even need her in the room with you, and you can still carry on an argument with her. How did Bean stand her? No doubt she didn't treat him like this. No, it was impossible to imagine that being nasty was something she could switch on and off. Bean had to have seen this side of her. And yet he stayed with her and loved her. Peter wondered what it would be like to have Petra look at him the way she looked at Bean. Then he corrected himself at once. Wonderful to have a woman look at him the way Petra looked at Bean. The last thing he wanted was a lovelorn Petra making googly eyes at him. The telephone rang.
The voice made sure it was Peter Jones and then said, 5 in the morning, be downstairs outside the north lobby doors. Click. Well, what brought that on? Something in Petra's and his argument? Peter had swept the room for bugs, but that didn't mean that they couldn't have some low-tech device like somebody in the next room with his ear pressed against the wall. What did we say to make them let me see the Caliph? Maybe it was what he had said about avoiding another bloody war. Or perhaps it was because they heard him admit to Petra that maybe he didn't have any legitimate authority. What if they recorded that? What if it suddenly surfaced on the web? Then it would happen, and he'd do his best to recover from the blow. And either he'd succeed or he'd fail. No point in fretting about it now. Somebody was meeting him at the north door of the lobby tomorrow morning before daylight. Maybe they'd lead him to Alai, and maybe he'd achieve what he needed to achieve, save all that he needed to save. He toyed with the idea of not telling Petra about the meeting. After all, she had no pertinent office at all. She had no particular right to be at the meeting, especially after their quarrel tonight. Don't be spiteful and petty, Peter told himself. One spiteful act brings too much pleasure. It just makes you want to do another and another, and sooner each time. So he picked up the phone, and on the 7th ring, she picked it up. I'm not going to apologize, she said curtly. Good, he said, because I don't want some smarmy, I'm sorry you got so upset, fake apology. What I want is for you to join me at 5 a.m. at the north door of the lobby. What for? I don't know, said Peter. I'm just passing along what I was just told on the telephone. He's going to let us see him? Or he's sending thugs to escort us back to the airport. How can I possibly know? You're the one who's his friend. You tell me what he's planning. I haven't the slightest idea, said Petra. It's not like Ally and I were ever close. And are you sure they want me to come to the actual meeting? There are plenty of Muslims who would be horrified at the thought of an unveiled married woman speaking face to face with a man, even the Caliph. I don't know what they want, said Peter. I want you at the meeting. They were ushered into a closed van and driven along a route that Peter assumed was convoluted and deceptively long. For all he knew, the Caliph's headquarters was next door to their hotel. But Ali's people knew that without the Caliph, there was no unity, and without unity, Islam had no strength. So they were taking no chances on letting outsiders know where the Caliph lived. They were driven far enough that they might be outside Damascus. When they emerged from the van, it was not in daylight. It was indoors or underground. Even the porticoed garden into which they were ushered was artificially lighted, and the sound of running and trickling and falling water masked any faint noises that might have seeped in from outside and hinted where they were. Ali did not so much greet them as notice their presence as he walked in the garden. He did not even face them, but sat a few meters away facing a fountain and began to speak. I have no desire to humiliate you, Peter Wiggin, he said. You should not have come. I appreciate your letting me speak with you at all, Peter answered. Wisdom said that I should announce to the world that the hegemon had come to see the Caliph, and the Caliph refused to see him. But I told wisdom to be patient and let folly be my guide today in this garden. Petra and I are here to— Petra is here, said Ali, because you thought her presence might get you in to see me, and you needed a witness that I would be reluctant to kill, and because you want her to be your ally after her husband is dead. Peter did not let himself glance at Petra to see how she took this sally from Ali. She knew the man. Peter did not. She would interpret his words as she saw fit, and nothing he could see in her face right now would help him understand anything. It would only weaken him to show he cared. I'm here to offer my help, said Peter. A command armies that ruled over more than half the population of the world, said Ali. I have united Muslim nations from Morocco to Indonesia and liberated the oppressed peoples in between. It's the difference between conquered and liberated that I wanted to talk about. So, you came to rebuke me. Not to help, after all, said Ali. I see, I'm wasting my time, said Peter. If we can't speak together without petty debate, then you are past receiving help. Help, said Ali. One of my advisors said to me, when I told them I wanted to see you, how many soldiers does this hegemon have? How many divisions has the Pope, quoted Peter. More than the hegemon has, said Ali, if the Pope should ask for them. As the old dead United Nations found out long ago, religion always has more warriors than some vague international abstraction. Peter realized then that Ali was not speaking to him. He was speaking past him. This was not a private conversation, after all. I do not intend to be disrespectful to the Caliph, said Peter. I have seen the majesty of your achievement and the generosity of spirit with which you have dealt with your enemies. Ali visibly relaxed. They were now playing the same game. Peter had finally understood the rules. What is to be gained from humiliating those who believe they stand outside the power of God? Asked Ali. God will show them his power in his own good time, and until then we are wise to be kind. Ali was speaking as the true believers around him required him to speak, always asserting the primacy of the caliphate over all non-Muslim powers. The dangers I came to speak of, said Peter, will not ever come from me or because of the small influence I have in the world. Though I was not chosen by God, and there are few who listen to me, I also seek, as you seek, the peace and happiness of the children of God on earth. Now was the time, if Ali was completely the captive of his supporters, for him to rant about how it was blasphemous for an infidel like Peter to invoke the name of God or pretend that there could be peace before all the world was under the rule of the caliphate. Instead, Ali said, I listen to all men, but obey only God. There was a day when Islam was hated and feared throughout the world, said Peter. That era ended long ago, before either of us were born, but your enemies are reviving those old stories. Those old lies, you mean, said Ali. The fact that no man can make the Hajj in his own skin and live, said Peter, suggests that not all the stories are lies. In the name of Islam, terrible weapons were acquired, and in the name of Islam, they were used to destroy the most sacred place on earth. It is not destroyed, said Ali. It is protected. It's so radioactive that nothing can live within 100 kilometers, said Peter. And you know what the explosion did to Al-Hajar, Al-Aswad. The stone was not sacred in itself, said Ali, and Muslims never worshipped it. We only used it as a marker to remember the holy covenant between God and his true followers. Now its molecules are powdered and spread over the whole earth as a blessing to the righteous and a curse to the wicked, while we who follow Islam still remember where it was and what it marked, and bow toward that place when we pray. It was a sermon he had surely said many times before. Muslims suffered more than anyone in those dark days, said Peter. But that is not what most people remember. They remember bombs that killed innocent women and children and fanatical self-murderers who hated any freedom except the freedom to obey the very narrowest interpretation of Sharia. He could see Ali stiffen. I make no judgment myself, Peter immediately said. I was not alive then. But in India and China and Thailand and Vietnam, there are people who fear that the soldiers of Islam did not come as liberators, but as conquerors.
that they'll be arrogant in victory, that the caliphate will never allow freedom to the people who welcomed him and aided him in overcoming the Chinese conquerors. We do not force Islam on any nation, said Ali, and those who claim otherwise are liars. We ask them only to open their doors to the teachers of Islam, so the people can choose. Forgive my confusion, then, said Peter. The people of the world see that open door and notice that no one passes through it except in one direction. Once a nation has chosen Islam, then the people are never allowed to choose anything else. I hope I do not hear the echo of the Crusades in your voice. The Crusades, thought Peter, that old bugbear. So Ali really has joined himself to the rhetoric of fanaticism. I only report to you what is being said among those who are seeking to ally against you in war, said Peter. That war is what I hope to avoid. What those old terrorists tried and failed to achieve, a worldwide war between Islam and everyone else, may now be almost upon us. The people of God are not afraid of the outcome of such a war, said Ali. It's the process of the war that I hope to avoid, said Peter. Surely the caliph also seeks to avoid needless bloodshed. All who die are at the mercy of God, said Ali. Death is not the thing to fear most in life, since it comes to all. If that's how you feel about the carnage of war, said Peter, then I've wasted your time. Peter leaned forward, preparing to rise to his feet. Petra put her hand on his thigh, pressing down, urging him to remain seated. But Peter had no intention of leaving. But, said Ali. Peter waited. But God desires the willing obedience of his children, not their terror. It was the statement that Peter had been hoping for. Then the murders in India, the massacre, there have been no massacres. The rumors of massacre, said Peter, which seemed to be supported by smuggled vids and eyewitness accounts and aerial photographs of the alleged killing fields. I am relieved that such things would not be the policy of the caliphate. If someone has slain innocents for no other crime than believing in the idols of Hinduism and Buddhism, then such a murderer would be no Muslim. What the people of India wonder, you do not speak for the people of any place, except a small compound in Hibero Preto, said Ali. What my informants in India tell me that the people of India wonder is whether the caliph intends to repudiate and punish such murderers or merely pretend that they didn't happen. Because if they cannot trust the caliph to control what is done in the name of Allah, then they will defend themselves. By piling stones in the road, asked Ali. We are not the Chinese to be frightened by stories of a great wall of India. The caliph now controls a population that has far more non-Muslims than Muslims, said Peter. So far, said Ali. The question is whether the proportion of Muslims will increase because of teaching or because of the slaughter and oppression of unbelievers. For the first time, Ali turned his head and then his body to face them. But it was not Peter he looked at. He only had eyes for Petra. Don't you know me? He said to her. Peter wisely did not answer. His words were doing their work, and now it was time for Petra to do what he had brought her to do. Yes, she said. Then tell him, said Ali. No, she said. Ali sat in wounded silence. Because I don't know whether the voice I hear in this garden is the voice of Ali or the voice of the men who put him into office and control who may or may not speak to him. It is the voice of the caliph, said Ali. I've read history, said Petra, and so have you. The sultans and caliphs were rarely anything but holy figureheads when they allowed their servants to keep them within walls. Come out into the world, Ali, and see for yourself the bloody work that's being done in your name.
They heard footsteps, loud ones, many footsteps, and soldiers trotted out of concealment. Within moments, rough hands held Petra and were dragging her away. Peter did not raise a hand to interfere. He only faced Ally, staring at him, demanding silently that he show who ruled in his house. "Stop," said Ally, not loudly, but clearly.
"No woman speaks to the Caliph like that,"
shouted a man who was behind Peter. Peter did not turn. It was enough to know that the man had spoken in common, not in Arabic, and that his accent bore the marks of a superb education. "Let go of her," Ally said to the soldiers, ignoring the man who had shouted. There was no hesitation. The soldiers let go of Petra. At once she came back to Peter's side and sat down. Peter also sat down. They were spectators now. The man who had shouted, dressed in the flowing robes of an imitation sheikh, strode up to Ally. "She uttered a command to the Caliph, a challenge. Her tongue must be cut out of her mouth." Ally remained seated. He said nothing. The man turned to the soldiers. "Take her," he said. The soldiers began to move. "Stop," said Ally, quietly but clearly. The soldiers stopped. They looked miserable and confused.
"He doesn't know what he's saying," the man said to the soldiers. "Take the girl, and then we'll discuss it later."
"Do not move, except at my command," said Ally. The soldiers did not move. The man faced Ally again. "You're making a mistake," he said. "The soldiers of the Caliph are witnesses," said Ally. "The Caliph has been threatened. The Caliph's orders have been countermanded. There is a man in this garden who thinks he has more power in Islam than the Caliph. So the words of this infidel girl are correct. The Caliph is a holy figurehead who allows his servants to keep him within walls. The Caliph is a prisoner, and others rule Islam in his name." Peter could see in the man's face that he now realized that the Caliph was not just a boy who could be manipulated.
"Don't go down this road," he said.
"The soldiers of the Caliph are witnesses," said Ally, "that this man has given a command to the Caliph, a challenge. But unlike the girl, this man has ordered armed soldiers in the presence of the Caliph to disobey the Caliph. The Caliph can hear any words without harm. But when soldiers are ordered to disobey him, it does not require an imam to explain that treason and blasphemy are present here. If you move against me," the man said, "then the others—" "The soldiers of the Caliph are witnesses," said Ally, "that this man is part of a conspiracy against the Caliph. There are others." One soldier came forward and laid a hand on the man's arm. He shook it off. Ally smiled at the soldier. The soldier took the man's arm again, but not gently. Other soldiers stepped forward. One took the man's other arm. The rest faced Ally, waiting for orders. "We have seen today that one man of my council thinks he is the master of the Caliph. Therefore, any soldier of Islam who truly wishes to serve the Caliph will take every member of the council into custody and hold them in silence until the Caliph has decided which of them can be trusted and which must be discarded from the service of God. Move quickly, my friends, before the ones who are spying on this conversation have time to escape." The man wrenched one hand free and in a moment held a wicked-looking knife, but Ally's hand was already firmly gripping his wrist. "My old friend," said Ally, "I know that you are not raising that weapon against your Caliph, but suicide is a grave and terrible sin. I refuse to allow you to meet God with your own blood on your hands." With a twist of his hand, Ally made the man groan with pain. The knife clattered on the flagstones.